Last time, I promised I was going to do this argument about how quantum causality leads into Hegel and German idealism, and I will do that next week. We'll get there. The plot, at least, is the following, which is here, that today, this account of the future of German idealism, the reputation, at least next week, and I will try to start the third antinomy, and if I cannot finish the third antinomy, then we'll just go on to the very final week. We'll take that extra week, and I will do the third antinomy. I mean, no sense doing all this and not solving the problem of freedom and necessity, which, after all, is, I don't know about anyone else, but it's the reason I started reading the problem. The solution to the problem of freedom and determinism. Kant has one. Okay, so the... just to quickly summarize, the strategy I was claiming overall was that the analogies attempted to show that there can be only one time, that time itself persists, that we have to have rules concerning both simultaneity and succession, since each simultaneity on its own it will give us distinct times, just leaps, right? This is simultaneous on another time. And equally succession on its own would just give us multiple chains with nothing linking them. So the very possibility of one of experience is the idea of the possibility of a unified temporal experience, and therefore the possibility of the experience of objects in one and the same time. And we have to be able to show that all objects are somewhen with respect to one another. There can't be an object or an event. There can't be an object or an event that is not temporally locatable with respect to anything else. Hence, the unity of experience requires the unity of time, and I suggested that the unity of time, therefore, grounds or gives kind of account of the unity of the world, or the unity of nature. And that the claim cannot be merely analytic, because causality is not analytically part of our account of either experience or knowledge. So something about the role of causality has got to be synthetic, nor is the argument merely epistemological, since it holds for scientific as well as ordinary experience. The indication is, there's a seat right here if you want it, at A218, long footnote, where he argues that the unity of the whole world, which all appearances have to be connected, is evidently a mere consequence of Catholic community of those substances, which are coexistence, blah, 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 blah. And then that last crucial sentence of that footnote at the bottom of the page, we have, however, in the proper context, shown that community is really the ground, community of objects, substances, is really the ground of the possibility of empirical knowledge of coexistence, and that the inference rightly regarded is simply from this empirical knowledge to community as its condition. So the argument is going from knowledge to the metaphysical or ontological conditions of knowledge. And that a lot of what I want to talk about today is exactly the extent to which this account of causality is going to be heavily metaphysical. The only writer on these topics that seems to me to get close to what I think Kant is doing is Eric Watkins, Kant and the Metaphysics of Causality. So if you really want to think about Kant and causality, it's only 400 pages. And he has, the book surprised me because he took a strategy that I had not considered, namely to try to generate the metaphysical model from Kant's earliest writings. My way of doing it is from Kant's main writings, but his strategy is interesting. He seems to me to get things about right. Okay. So where we ended. Okay, so last time where we ended, we were just finishing the first analogy, and the argument that I suggested works, or comes close to working, is an argument that has the form that nothing can count as a direct perception of the absence of anything, including the absence of a state of affairs. Hence, in order for us to have an idea of change, we have to have the idea that we have a different state of affairs than we had previously. And in order to have a compelling account of a state of affairs being different from a previous state of affairs, but connected to it, we have to have the idea of state of affairs as such that the nature of the object concerned does not allow of it of being in the two states of affairs at the same time. I have to exclude one another. Hence, the absence of one, right, and the presence of the other is indicative of a change because they are mutually exclusive. So, I can see you're just looking puzzled. So the water cannot be both liquid and steam, or liquid and ice, or ice and steam at the same time. So we have an idea that the water has changed, because those two states of affairs exclude one another. So we postulate the states as being of something that endures, the water. The water has changed its state from liquid to steam. So we see, we comprehend, we grasp the change against the background of the unchanging, and the intelligibility of the change requires that. Kant pushes that argument one step further. We already read A188, and in the very next paragraph, he pushes that argument a little further, where he says, substances in the field of appearance are the substrata of all determinations of time. If some of these substances could come into being and others cease to be, the one condition of the empirical unity of time would be removed. Why? Next sentence. The appearances would then relate to two different times, and existence would flow in two parallel streams, which is absurd. To imagine something either going clean out of existence or popping into existence makes it temporally discontinuous with anything else, not a change of anything to anything, and therefore in place, incapable of being placed, and therefore whatever it begets, unplaceable, and hence you generate the idea of separate temporal streams. So there's some sense, Kant wants to argue, where the possibility of the intelligibility, and I want to say intelligibility, not verification, although verification is interesting, but the very intelligibility of change presupposes an unchanging, the presumption of an unchanging background. That we always have the sense of the enduring against which we see change. And that the business of science, as I mentioned last time, is often tracking down exactly where everything's gone, right? To see what's changed into what. Something must endure. So already in this first analogy, shows that he's committed to some notion of substance by which he means at the very least enduring particulars, and maximally he's actually committed to the permanence of substance, that which is unchanging. That commitment lays itself out, we're going to come to. I think it's a large commitment. Well, obviously the real states are the second analogy. Although for reasons I'm going to come to, the second analogy and the third analogy I've already made clear cannot be done independently of one another. So I think it's been a mistake to try to separate the analogies generally, and in particular to downplay the third analogy. And as I'll also say somewhere, that the third analogy clarifies some of Kant's metaphysical commitments. People have searched in the second analogy for a decisive refutation of Hume. And as close as it is, you have a handout with an argument from Lewis White Beck, which I'll say something about. But Beck's argument, I think, is as close as there is. On the whole, I want to think about the second analogy in a different way. Well, why? Well, what you challenge was the idea that there could be logically necessary relations between distinct substances or events. That's what he denied. That there was a logical necessity of if A, then B. And roughly, the reason he thought, decided there wasn't being an intuition or an impression of cause, just regularity, he also thought that, what's Hume's model of logical necessity? Anyone?
The contrary implies a contradiction.
Yeah, that is logical necessity.
Just habituation, habit custom.
That would be the opposite of necessity. That would be contingency. What's actualness?
Mm-hmm. Well, I might misunderstand your question, but he basically says that he can imagine the contrary without contradiction. Therefore, there's no necessity between. There's no necessary connection between A and B. You just can imagine the opposite.
Right, but I'm asking, what is logical necessity? What's his example of logical necessity?
Yeah.
Well, no. Well, could be. it's something that's analytically true. True in terms of the meaning of the term. All bachelors are unmarried males, or but it's an analytic truth. But if it's an analytic truth, then of course the two elements cannot be logically distinct, right? So the very idea of distinct events and logical necessity cannot be put together. Right? So Hume has two claims, right? One is we do not have an impression of causation, all we perceive as regularity, one thing then another, rather, and furthermore, they cannot be logically connected because all logical truths are analytic truths, which, by the way, the rationalists agree with. Well, that was the nature of the challenge. By 1764, Kant had already begun distinguishing between what I'm going to call the logical grounds of an event and its real ground. That is, he was already beginning to see that you could not go very far by staying with logic alone. That said, no one in Germany, and this is just worth knowing, including Kant, accepted Hume's view of causality. No one. What they claimed, what everyone agreed was, is that Hume offers no account of either objective necessity, he just gives you this account of regularity. Well, that's not an account of necessity, of causality, that's an account of exactly regularity. And therefore, he gives no intelligibility to the idea of causality. The debate in Germany didn't take Hume seriously for a second in a positive way. Only in England could that happen, in the world of empiricism. The debate in Germany was, given Hume's challenge, could an account of causality be generated in Leibnizian terms? That's what really the argument was about. And Kant was breaking from Leibniz and realizing that no, it couldn't be given in Leibnizian terms. Leibniz accepted too much of the logical apparatus. So Kant's position in the Critique begins to depart from you in all sorts of ways. I will mention here just four. First, he understands the problem of causality in a transcendental context. That is, he now thinks that the question of causality and mutual interaction are necessary for the possibility of experience. That he has a new location for the very notion of causality. That is, causality now turns out to be a condition of knowledge of a single world, since it turns out that causal rules and rules of mutual interaction are necessary for knowledge of successive and simultaneous states of affairs. So it's a transcendental setting that he's after, which is to say it's neither empiricist nor rationalist. Secondly, he introduces, quite distinctly from Hume, but consistent with some Leibnizianism, a different metaphysics of causality. Namely, causality does not consist of events, but, and this is what I'm going to try to convince you of today, causal powers. And I'm going to say a lot about it because it's one of these things that I simply don't know why analytic philosophers continue to reject the idea of causal powers. Why they remain, even with all their scientism and naturalism, within an essentially empiricist framework, which is, I'm going to claim, itself essentially anti-naturalistic. Thirdly, Kant's going to argue that one substance can cause an effect in another substance just in case one acts on the other. So suddenly the notion of activity or the exercise of a capacity or the exercise of a causal power becomes fundamental again to the account of what we think a causal event involves. And for reasons that I'll say are important, in the case of mutual interaction, finally, the exercise of causal powers must be joined because they must be reciprocal. And reciprocity, as we'll come to, is something that Hume and even Schopenhauer found unintelligible. I'll explain why it was unintelligible to everyone before. So Kant has a wholly different way of thinking about causality. Hence, it ain't surprising that in the first edition of the Critique, he only mentions Hume, I think, by name three times. You would think from reading analytic literature, he was writing about Hume all the time. And I think the right way to think about all this is that Kant does not answer Hume directly. That is, he does not show, and no one could show, that distinct events are logically connected. That's the obvious thing that Hume asks for. And no, that's not what Kant demonstrates. Indeed, by the time Kant is done giving his account of what a causal event is just incommensurable with Hume, which is really the important thought, I think. That he introduces us to another framework of thinking, and therefore tries to give us a different understanding. So, and one of the points I'm making here is there is a kind of fetishism, even in this class, with the notion of refuting the skeptic. And sometimes it's like the bully in the pub. The best way to deal with the bully in the pub often is to walk away. Go to another pub where everyone is friendly. Not always. But to say this is I am suggesting that I want us to again, I'm trying to show, and this of course is consistent with my notion of the regressive strategy, right? That what we're doing is introducing a different framework rather than a direct refutation. So by distinguishing real from logical grounds, Kant is going to introduce a notion of natural necessity in place of logical necessity. And of course, in order to do so, you can now begin to see some of the depth of this problem, because obviously Hume thinks that there are only relations of ideas and matters of fact, things analytically related or contingently and synthetically related, and that exhausts the possibilities. Therefore, for Hume, all necessity must be logical necessity. And there could be nothing else. So if Kant is going to think about some notion of real grounds, he's going to require a faculty of knowledge other than pure reason. The sort of reason that analyzes ideas. And of course, he's going to require principles beyond identity and contradiction. The new faculty is the understanding, That's what we've been analyzing all along. And it's going to provide explanations of the form that, well, the principles of the analogies themselves. So it's this new faculty, right, that avoids, that introduces a new notion of necessity into the story via the transcendental story. So Kant's response to you overall is not, again, the direct refutation of skepticism, but even in those passages where he talks about Hume, mostly in the methodology and the dialectic, he talks about it as in terms of an orientation that views skepticism as intrinsically unstable. That on the one hand, skepticism oversteps the mark when it infers from its ignorance of certain dogmatic truths, ignorance of reason altogether, Hume's repudiation of reason in defense of the imagination, it's called his logical defeatism, simply because reason cannot answer what? Kant's going to say, answer questions it has no business answering. Right? So to generate skepticism because you can't answer dogmatic questions, freedom, God, immortality of the soul, that's not a reason to doubt reason. That's a reason to doubt God. Go the other way around. Right? And of course, that's the flip side, is, and of course the other thing is he thinks that skepticism is susceptible to self-referential problems, which you knew. Right? Turns on itself. On the other hand, so the general strategy against you is a critique of pure reason. Right? That is an account of the powers and limits of reason. And in scoping out the powers and limits of reason, Kant, on the one hand, as we're about to do, attempts to provide foundations for science and mathematics and empirical knowledge, and on the other hand, all that, the synthetic a priori stuff, and on the other hand, accepts skepticism over certain dogmatic claims. Doesn't want to refute them, wants to insist upon them. So we're not going to discover a knockdown, an irrefutable refutation of you. We're going to change the terrain. And change it so that it's quite different from even the dominant trends within analytic analyses of causality. Let me say a word about what those are, just so you are aware of what the stories or existing stories about causality are. And the bottom line is that most analytic philosophers except use event ontology in some way or other. So, the late David Lewis, in the introduction to his collection of essays, gives a perfectly typical statement of the event ontology. David Lewis was one of the weirdest men I've ever met. Of course, you know he was the great interrogator of possible world logic. And of course, his famous statement is that all possible worlds are equal. That is, there's no reason to prefer this world over any other possible world, since this world is just one more possible world. And he said, and if you met him, it was became terrifyingly true, that he had no intuitions that would lead him to think that this world was any different than any other possible world. He was a realist about possible worlds. He was odd. They, and of all things, they loved him in Australia. It is the doctrine, what he calls, he's calling this human superhumans, it is the doctrine that all there is to the world is a vast mosaic of local matters of particular fact. Just one little thing, and then another. We have geometry, a system of external relations of spatio-temporal distance between points. Maybe points of space-time itself, maybe point-sized bits of matter, or ether, or fields, maybe both. And at those points, we have local qualities, perfectly natural intrinsic properties, which need nothing bigger than a point at which to be instantiated. For short, we have an arrangement of qualities. And that is all. There is no difference without difference in the arrangement of qualities. All else, that is, causality, laws of nature, counterfactuals, persistence through time, supervenes on that. What does it take to think of the world like that? What's the temptation? This question. Well, of course, it's simplicity, it's elegance, it's not question begging. So the tendency, therefore, are to provide counts of causality in terms of regularity. That is a straight Humean one. And of course, you can do a variety of things with regularity. That is, you can choose regularities that are simplicity or informativeness or strength or some other criteria to figure out which regularities you're going to do. But one is just to go with regularities. The second is counterfactual dependence. That is, something will count as a cause if and only if it supports a counterfactual, that is, have the initial condition been different, something else would have happened. Statistical relations,
roughly the causal ones are the ones with high probabilities. And nomological subsumption. That is, something will count. This is this takes the distinction between particulars and universals seriously. And the thought is that it belongs to the universal water that it boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, say. So you take an event, an instance, and you put it under the universal, and it's somehow the universals are in that relation of necessity. Why that might be true? The oddity is that they want to argue that universals are not derived from particulars, because I think that would be circular. So it really is about a subsumption of universals. So it's a kind of belief in universals. Yet, it is peculiar. And it's peculiar why? The last one? Because universals don't cause anything. It's one event that causes another event. So kind of discovering the heart of it in the universal looks odd. Okay, I'm not going to try to go through all of the analytic theories of causality. But I do want to give you this sense that what Kant is doing is very distinct. Okay. Well, at the heart of the second analogy, there appears to be, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to start very intuitively. So the way it's going to go, I'm going to start intuitively, then we'll look at some of the formal arguments, and then I'm going to build up the metaphysical story. Okay. We'll work a bit by that. Kant sets up the problem, as we already know, by asking how it is possible to distinguish between objective succession from unchanging states of affairs. And there is a problem here. And the problem is easy again. All experience is successive. We always perceive one thing, then another thing, then another thing. Okay. Now, even though we always perceive, our perceptions are always successive, not all of our perceptions are of succession. On the contrary, most of what we perceive is not of succession, it's of simultaneous states of affairs. So, when I see the right wall and I see the left wall, I'm seeing, you know, not one thing. I don't think the right wall causes the left wall. I don't think the ceiling causes the wall behind it. So the order of my perceptions is not a clue to things happening in the world. On the contrary, I'm pretty sure nothing's happening. Now, when Kant gets his first shot at thinking about this, is to think about, quite rightly, although it can be misleading how he's going to use it, he's going to think about reversible and non-reversible sequences. And the famous examples are the example of the boat and the house. And kind of a rare thing in Kant, in a way, that the argument really does build up around those two simple examples. And at least one of them is completely misleading. So that may or may not be helpful. So the thought, we'll read the passages in a second, is quite simple. I see the boat moving downstream, and there's nothing I can do to change the order of the sequence of my perceptions. I first see it, you know, the background against the jetty, and then against that big yacht, and then against the far shore. And I see it in those positions, and I cannot see it in any other order. The order of my perceptions seems to be bound down to what is occurring. On the other hand, when I am touring my way around the house, it's true enough. I first see the front door, and then I see the first story windows, second story windows, and the roof. But I can easily reverse the order. That is, I can just as happily see the roof and then the second story, first story door. So that the order of my perceptions is fully reversible. Well, my perceptions are, in that sense, order indifferent, temporarily. And that is indicative, right? In that case, that I am not perceiving, despite the fact that I'm seeing and having a succession of perceptual states, I'm actually perceiving an enduring object. While in the case of the boat, because the order of my perceptions is bound down, then there is subjective succession, just to use the technical vocabulary, should be interpreted as objective succession. That is, as really succession in the world. So some subjective succession is to be comprehended as objective succession, and those are the ones that are irreversible. And some subjective successions are not of changes in the world, but simply of the movement of my eyes or my body, my having a different take on the object, but what is staying the same is the object. I'm moving, not it.
So, irreversibility is certainly playing a kind of fundamental role, although it is not, I think, a criterion. Because a criterion, we wouldn't have a theory of causality, we just have a theory of irreversibility. Rather, what we're going to say is something more like a sequence cannot appear in a different order only if there is a rule determining that order. And we're going to call that rule, and a rule that determines order is what a causal law is. So we will have a perception of objective succession only if we can frame our experience as being determined by rules of a causal nature. That is, if A occurs, B follows on it with necessity. Hence, the very idea of being able to distinguish objective from subjective succession presupposes the principle of causality.
That's the short version.
So let's think about it a little bit. The first thing I want to say here is the idea is that given a certain instance of objective succession, Kant wants to say that the order of our perceptions is necessary. It's because the order of our perceptions is necessary that the irreversible. So irreversibility follows objective succession rather than leading the way. Cause, the cause of something, and here the boat example is massively unhelpful. So let's look at the boat example. Let's talk about it for a moment and then see why it's a little bit unhelpful. So it's A192. But as I also know, in an appearance which contains a happening, the preceding state of the perception you may entitle A, the succeeding B, B can be apprehended only as following upon A. The perception A cannot follow upon B, but only precede it. That's the irreversible one. For instance, I see a ship move downstream. My perception of its lower position follows upon the perception of its position higher up in the stream. And it is impossible that in the apprehension of this appearance, the ship should first be perceived lower down in the stream
and afterwards higher up. The order in which the perceptions succeed one another in apprehension is in this instance determined, and so this order, apprehension is bound down. In the previous example of a house, my perceptions could begin with the apprehension of the roof and end with the basement, or could begin from below and end above, and I could simply apprehend the manifold, etc. But in the perception of an event, there is always a rule that makes the order in which the perceptions and the apprehension of this appearance follow upon one another a necessary order. Why is the boat example not felicitous here? How would you interpret it causally?
The river?
The river, that's interesting.
I feel it's pushing the boat.
Great, that's not what he says. All right, so why is, so it's infelicitous because it sounds as if the position upstream causes the position downstream. And that's not true. Positions don't, nothing, one, the boat in one position doesn't cause it to be in another position. What causes the ship to be in first one position and then another position is the river and the wind and whatever is the causal mechanism. So the thought here, and now this is, well, why am I saying this? I'm trying to get you away from thinking about events, right? I'm trying to say, you know, it's not the event of the ship here and the ship there and how are they logically connected. I want to say that there is a causal rule, namely, given the ship, and, you know, given it has no locomotion, and given it's this river, you know, flowing downstream, there's just no way. Given the causal laws, you know, you try it, you'll wash downstream. That's the causal thing. So the necessity, the relation of necessity, does not hold between the successive states. That's the thought I wanted you to get out of the infelicity of the boat example. The necessity does not hold between the successive states, but rather between the cause, say the river or the wind on the sails or whatever it is, and the effect, that is, the successive states. The successive states, it's the cause causes it to be first here, then there. Right? It's the force of the river, exactly. So necessity is between cause and effect. And the successive states of the effect rather than the successive states themselves. There are, I'm going to argue, necessary connections in nature, but no justification for a necessary connection between successive states. Just the wrong kind of animal. But that entails that there are going to be ontological conditions for objective succession. And that means that causality, and I'm going to show you this in the text, causality must be more than an inference ticket. Talking about causality cannot be mere, if you say this, you're allowed to say that talk. That's kind of bad Bob Brandom idealism. Iteration of bad Bob Brandom. Okay, so knowledge of objective temporal relations is going to require ontological principles, if I'm right, just on the basis of the boat example and what we've done so far, or we might say that the necessary conditions, and this should be unsurprising now because I'm just going to restate the principle of the metaphysics of experience, namely the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience are also necessary conditions for the possibility of the objects of experience. And now I want to say what Kant must mean by that when he gives that thick sense of necessary for the objects of experience, that we are determining in some thick or rich sense a metaphysics of experience, that is, a metaphysics of the world as determined by our transcendental orientation. Okay, that's the kind of framework I want to run with. Maybe that's a good place, I haven't started giving analysis yet, but that's a good place maybe to take a deep breath, and then we'll look at the actual arguments and build from there.